to Sight.
Spend the day with Sight. From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Radio Sight Thursday Live.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's segment of Afternoon Satsang. And as per our schedule, we are going to progress into the next part of the nectarine sweet story of Lord Sri Rama, the Ramakatha Rasavahini.
Shri Raghavam Dasharatatmajamaprameyam Sitapatim Raghukulanmayaratnadipam Janubavum Aravindadalayakaksham Ramam Nishachara Vina Shakaram Namami Namami
offering a humble pranam to Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang, wherein we're going to talk about the Ramakatha Rasavahini. I welcome all of you to join us in this satsang and also welcome Arvind back. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, and it feels really, really wonderful to be back. You know, a Himalayan pilgrimage is a Himalayan one in every sense, and I just do not have sufficient words to express how jubilant my heart is, how elevated my mind feels, and how light and fantastic I feel in the body. It's really so wonderful. But you know, all this pilgrimage and all this visit to different places just come and reinforce one very most important message to me almost every year, and that is what a privilege and joy it is to have known Swami, to be able to love Him, to be able to receive His love, and to be able to live for Him. It is really a great privilege and a great honor, and all of us should celebrate every moment of our lives, for we have known Swami. Well, that was my what was uppermost in my mind, now that I have, having said that, coming to the Ramakatha Rasavahini, you know, we began with this shloka, Shri Raghavam.
Right.
I cannot but help think of how many times Swami must have heard this. I think at least about 2,000 to 3,000 times, right? I mean, this Shri Raghunandana bhajan with this alap, it used to be a kind of all-time favorite. And Swami would look and He would indicate with one word. He would say slokam. Slokam means it has to be this bhajan with this alap. And there have been different singers who were anointed or appointed to sing this bhajan. The singers changed, the times changed, but not apparently nothing changed in Swami's love for this particular bhajan. And if you see, you know, a kind of, Swami has done summer course on Ramayana, on the story of Rama, and this bhajan we already spoke about. And during Ram Navami, in detail, you know, the way Swami has explored Rama's life. In fact, this is the only Vahini, I think, that has been written in two parts, the Ram Katha Rasa Vahini, so much. It reminds me of what is said, that one can always follow Krishna's words, Lord Krishna's teachings, follow Krishna's words, and follow Lord Rama's actions. I wish to start off this today's satsang with this thought, you know, that we should follow Lord Krishna's words and Lord Rama's actions. Having spent some time contemplating on this, this is something that I've arrived at, and let me share it with you and all our listeners.
Okay.
See, if we look at the way good, the balance of good and bad exists in the universe, when we look at the dashavatars, starting from Matsya, through Kurma, Varaha, Narahari, Vamana, Parashurama, Narasimha, Vamana, Narasimha, Parashurama, Rama, Krishna, coming till our own Purna avatar, Shri Satya Sai. In the beginning, it was almost as if there are some isolated or stray incidents of negativity or evil. And so, the Lord did not take an avatar in sense of having a birth, a growth, and then reaching adulthood and then accomplishing the task and going. They were all amshavatars.
Right.
Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, Narasimha. They all arrived at one particular moment, the moment of reckoning, when action needed to be taken. And having taken the action, that was the end of the avatar. The first sort of a Purna avatar, where the Lord takes birth, goes through childhood, and basically gives us a beautiful story to live and relive. It starts with Ramavatar. In the Ramavatar, we see that, you know, the good and bad is clearly segregated. There is one dynasty that is bad. There is one dynasty that is good. So, the Lord had to take birth in the good dynasty and go and destroy the bad dynasty. That's all it was. So, Rama took birth in the lineage of Raghu, and he destroys the Rakshasas who were being ruled by Ravana. Then we come to the Krishnavatar times. Now here things got a little more complicated. They were good and bad within the same family. In the Kuru family, which was the ruling race at that time from Hastinapura, there were the good, the dharmic and the adharmic. And so now Krishna had a little tougher time, you know, if we take it that way, because he had to first segregate within the same family the good and bad. If we see the Kaurava war, that's what happens. Even from among the Kauravas, a few people joined the Pandavas before the war. And, you know, again, there had to be, in the Lord's own family, among the Yadavas themselves, some had to be destroyed, some had to be protected. So Krishna had a tougher time. So he had to segregate the good and bad within the family and then destroy.
Okay.
You know, and I feel that is the reason why they say don't follow Krishna's actions. Because unless you are in that Krishna Tattva, you are lost in that beauty and wisdom of the Lord, you will not be able to appreciate. It will appear as if there are so many discrepancies. And that is what has happened also, you know, when people skim at the surface, they think that a lot of things Krishna did, Krishna himself did adharmic things, and what do you say for this? That is why it is said, don't follow the actions of Krishna. Just follow his words. And you know, I was thinking further along these lines, and now when we look at Kali Yuga, it is not as if even in a, it has got even more complicated. Because the good and bad exist within the same individual. It is so tough, and no wonder Swami said that this time the avatar has come armed with the weapon of love. Because if he has to destroy the bad people as such, it will result in mass scale destruction and there will be nobody alive. And so therefore it is even more complicated. This line of thought, when I was thinking, I just felt that if it is said, don't try to understand the actions of Krishna and try to follow it because it's too complicated, then what can be said about the actions of our dear Lord Swami? When we try to explain him, when we try to think why Swami is doing this, why Swami is doing that, how futile it is. Because situation is so much more complicated. The same individual is good. You don't have a good individual and a bad individual. The same individual is good at times and in circumstances, and he is bad in times and circumstances. So that, you know, it, when we go on such pilgrimages, as I said, coming back to the opening thoughts, you get to know so much about these avatars, previous avatars. And, you see the admiration, you see the devotion, and then you realize how much more devotion we should have towards our dear Swami for having taken up such a complicated task and having done it so beautifully and apparently so effortlessly. So, as I said, studying more of Rama's life or Krishna's life only makes me grow more and more in love, devotion and wonder of our dear Swami's life.
Very beautiful. And what you said kind of reminds me of what I've heard from a person about, especially comparison of Rama, Krishna and Swami.
Hmm.
Very often we've spoken about this before, Rama is referred to as Atma Rama. Because if you look at Rama's life, I think a part of it we will even dwell upon today. It is a journey of a sadhaka, literally.
Hmm.
You know, when the soul goes out to reveal itself, to discover itself, the processes that a person goes through.
Hmm.
That is what we really see in the life of Lord Rama. So that is why it is said that it is always good to follow the life of Rama. Because that is why the life of Rama itself is supposed to be an example. What Rama said throughout is something which is, you know, in pockets we understand. Swami always quotes what he said before the war, what he said when Vibhishana came to him. You know, there are moments of idealism, but in general his life itself can be followed because it is the life of a sincere aspirant till the final revelation of his inner divinity comes. That is why you can follow Rama.
Mm.
And when you come to Krishna, Krishna is the expression of a realized soul.
Hmm.
That is why Krishna's avatar is referred to as the Jnana avatar.
Hmm.
So Rama's is Dharma avatar and Krishna's is supposed to be Jnana avatar. The one who has attained his realization, you can never pin him down to his actions. You know, you cannot say why he did this. He says this, he did this. You know, the actions of a realized soul are so erratic that it's very difficult to understand the actions. That is why it is said, don't follow the actions of Krishna. Because it is that of the expression of one who has attained perfection. And that can confuse you if you want to literally follow.
So that's what, unless you attain that perfection.
Unless you attain that perfection, it is very difficult to understand why Krishna did this, why he said that, and why he made others do that. So it is very complicated. Coming to Swami, and you really nailed it when you said that, you know, Swami had to equip himself with the armory of love. Because Swami's is that of Premavatar. And when you talk of love, it becomes even more obscure, even more difficult, because as it is said, everything is fair in love and war. And when Swami does everything with that love, it becomes even more difficult to understand his actions.
Hmm.
Because the only thing which you can, at the end of the day, say is, Swami did this out of his love. That will be the only correct thing you can tell about Swami. If you go into the details of why he did this, why he set up the ashram, why he did this to such and such a person, and why he put this person, we will only get more and more complicated. The final underlying principle is Swami did it out of his love.
The everything else is mere speculation and imagination.
So putting it in, should I say, in jargons, the life of Rama was that of a Dharma avatar, the life of Krishna was that of a Jnana avatar, and life of our dear Swami is that of a Prema avatar.
Beautifully put, Prem. And so therefore, it is so beautiful that, you know, before this we had taken Satyam Shivam Sundaram, we enjoyed the life of the Prema avatar, and now that we have taken Ramkatha Rasa Vahini, it is a little more simpler, if we can say, in terms of action. It makes things a little more easier for us because it directly says that we can follow the actions of Rama.
Right.
So why not dive straight into Rama's story and look at all the things that he did and the way he conducted his life, so that we can directly derive inspiration from that and put it into practice in our own lives. I think we had stopped at the point when the princes have been sent for education to Vasishtha, right?
Right. They will be named, and we spoke about how the naming ceremony happened and how that natural pairing happened of Rama and Lakshmana and Bharata and Shatrughna and all that, right? We are at the point where they are about to embark on their education.
Yeah, even when they went to their preceptor, that is Vasishtha, for education. This was for education into learning and, you know, fine arts, the Vedas, the Shastras, the scriptures, basically, because the Vedas are apaurusheya. They have come directly from God, and there is no composer for the Vedas. That is why the sages who wrote them down are called mantra drashtaras, meaning those who saw the hymns. It is not as if they composed it. It just appeared before them. So it is apaurusheya, meaning having no single author. It has come directly from the Lord. And these were texts that had to be imparted to every child. And therefore, for the first few years after they turned 6, you know, in the current day it would be first grade, second grade. That is when, up to the primary and middle schooling, they would be taken over to their preceptor's place, the Gurukula system of education. You know, at this point, it just becomes like a very, very valid digression to speak on how beautiful this Gurukula system of education is. Because, you know, when Rama, Lakshmana, Bharata, Shatrughna, they go and stay with their guru, that is Vashishta. They stay, and so it is not as if the only time they see their teacher is in their classroom. They have nothing like a classroom, because everything becomes a classroom, which justifies this period as a learning period, because this is a period where you learn from everything. The hermitage from morning waking up at sunrise till you go to bed after sunset at night, you are with the guru. You learn not only from his words but also from his actions. And that is what began when Rama and his brothers went to the hermitage of Vashishta.
And the interesting thing about these Gurukulas is, as you were saying, you know, they are supposed to leave their princely life, their life in the palace, and then go and live in the Gurukula as just another student.
Mm.
You know, very similar to what Swami did in his education institutions. You know, one of the things which we have always noticed is this habit of wearing whites. One of the ideas behind it is that, you know, you shed your differences of who is more wealthier, who is coming from a more, you know,
affluent family.
You know, that is taken away when you bring this common code of, in fact, even in schools, the reason why you have
a uniform
is, that is the thing. But here, Swami, you know, continued it even till your, when you're doing your PhD also, you're wearing the same uniform. You know, that barrier is gone. You don't know which person comes from which region. You don't know which person comes from a, you know, affluent family or a poor family. Those differences are removed in that stage of development. And that was an important thing which was achieved through that Gurukula system.
And, you know, speaking about the white dress, there are other things also which emphasize the same thing. For example, all of us in the hostel, irrespective of what we can afford, we eat the same food. If we feel that the food that, you know, in the sense, I don't think I can get such kind of food at home because I am coming from a poor background. I get this. It's not as if that I will, because I have never had such things, I will not be given that. At the same time, if I feel that, you know, I can have dishes that are delicacies that are 10 times more grand than what is being given here. No, you're not allowed. You still have to have this. Again, the common kitchen. And I can go on and on. You know, there are other things like the self-reliance activities that we had in our hostel, where you have to be a contributing member of the society. That is what happened even in the Gurukula, you know. The brothers and the others who had come, all the students had to take up the activities at the hermitage.
Right.
Some would clean. Everybody would be involved in cleaning the hermitage, in maintaining the garden, growing the food. And, you know, even if it meant begging for the food, whether you're a king, whether you're a pauper, everybody had to take their turns to do all the activities. And it was literally like one family where all the happinesses are shared, all the sorrows are shared, the ups are shared, the downs are shared. So totally this kind of, you know, discrimination, distinction is wiped out. You really experience the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God.
Right. And, you know, unlike in the current days, there is no question of you going on for a vacation and all that. You know, if you look at all these things, it is for that period of time you go and stay in the ashram. You don't even have a break. You don't go for a 2-month summer vacation or anything.
Mm.
And I think that is when, once in a while, the king was allowed to come and visit the wards and inquire from the master about their well-being and their progress. I think that is how Dasharatha happened to come to the ashram after a few years.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm just going back a little bit. Even in the ashram, you know, this pairing that we spoke about between Rama and Lakshmana and Bharata Shatrughna, that happened to be seen. You know, Rama was an excellent student, and no prizes for guessing why, the avatar, and the way he progressed, in the chanting of Vedas, picking up Vedas, the Guru Vashishta felt almost as if, you know, Rama knows everything. He doesn't need me to teach him. He almost seems to be having the knowledge beforehand itself. And so, Swami writes in the Ramkatha Rasavahini so beautifully that Vasishtha felt that Rama is a super fast student and he needs to be given special attention because he can progress much faster. And so Rama was in a special category. Bharata, Shatrughna and Lakshmana were in the next category. So it is like they are given the same, but since his grasping power is more, why not feed him with more? That was the idea. But then Vasishtha notices that strangely Bharata, Lakshmana and Shatrughna are falling behind in their studies. He wonders what is it that is happening, and then he sees that they are very sad. Why are they sad? They are sad at being separated from Rama. And that is when Lakshmana tells Vasishtha that, sir, please, I don't know what it is, but we would like to be with Rama always. Please don't separate us from Rama. Because if we are separated from Rama, all this holds no meaning for us. Rama is what is most important. And so please let us be with Rama, irrespective of what happens. And it is after that Vasishtha brings back, you know, all the four brothers together. And when I was reading this, it just struck me as to how important it is that even when we are getting our education, when we are going through our schooling or our college, university education, our focus must be Rama, you know. In the sense, as Swami puts it, there are two vidya, that is Adhyatma vidya, and there is the worldly education that we need. Worldly education is for a living. The true Atma vidya is for educare, it is for life.
Right.
So I feel Rama represents educare there, Rama divinity. He is the true essence of life. It is such a beautiful example for us in this story. You know, it's another metaphor to show how during our how we should conduct ourselves during our studying days, that our focus should always be Rama. If we are given skills and talents and if we are imparted education, keeping Rama away, it is not wholesome education, and we should never be satisfied, because education becomes complete only if God is part of the education, if values are part of the education, if Atma Vidya, what Swami stresses, higher learning is part of education. So and therefore, whether we are parents or whether we are students learning, we should keep this in mind that education becomes wholesome and complete only when it has this Atma Vidya component, Rama component to it.
And you know, one more beautiful way Swami puts it in that chapter in Ramkatha Rasavahini, he says when Vasishtha starts teaching Rama, Swami says that he actually witnesses that scene of educare. And Swami says that whatever teaching is done is to bring out the knowledge from within.
Hmm.
Vasishtha is surprised by the gush of knowledge from Rama, because he is telling it, he's not repeating like somebody who is learning those mantras, but he's telling it as the one who is the source of all those mantras. And you know, the joy which the guru feels when seeing a disciple like that, who realizes the perfection of teaching itself, because when you teach, you're only, as Swami always said, it's educare, it's bringing out from within. When he's teaching Rama, he's feeling the joy of seeing that perfect student who is able to mine out that knowledge so easily. And it's a fulfilling experience even for Vasishtha. That's how Swami puts it. And you know, that's a very important thing, because Swami always emphasizes when he speaks about education, remember that you are only bringing out from within. And all your education should aim at bringing out those values from within. You know, you are equipping with skills, that is definitely important, but don't get so lost in that, bringing those skills into the student that you forget that what you're doing is to bring out the divinity from within.
Beautiful. Another interesting aspect here, though it is not explicitly mentioned in the Ramkatha Rasavahini, if we just study it slowly, we realize is the great sacrifice that Dasharatha and the parents did. It is very, very exemplary, and it is something that all the, you know, the parents can learn from. You see, Dasharatha was the emperor. He was a supreme emperor. He could have built a palace for Rama to study. He had great love for Rama and the other three. When I say Rama and other three, it means he had great love for all the four of his sons. He loved them dearly. They were the apple of his eyes. And yet he understood the need for him to keep out of the education. You know, we often see this happening. We feel that we express our love for our children by pampering them because we can afford to. We do not realize that we are actually hindering their actual education, where they have to learn equality, they have to learn their oneness with everyone else. How many problems arise in class because I'm speaking especially when we see day scholars, when we see students going to the class, some people have a very, very posh pencil box, a geometry box, a school bag, labels on the books. They are so posh and they are so fantastic, they are so alluring, the other children feel left out. See, it is not that I express my love for my child, I love my child, so therefore I can afford it, it is well within my reach. Let me remember that there are so many others who can't afford such a thing, and if their child comes, what an impact it has. In childhood itself, among the children itself, a kind of social ranking comes in. We see that pecking order coming into place in the social fabric of a classroom, where somebody feels that this boy is higher, this boy is lower, this girl is higher, this girl is lower. So it involves a lot of wisdom and sacrifice from the parents also. They should realize that when I love my child, an actual and true expression of this love is to make the child realize these values of life. So that is why, irrespective if we see in the Ramayana and if we see in the ancient days as such, irrespective of the social position, all were kept equal. It becomes easier in the hostels. But you see, even in the hostels, if you remember, Prem, during the vacation, the warden would speak to the parents saying that, you know, this is what we have done in the hostel. Please ensure that you continue the same during the vacation. You know, morning we get up at 5. It is definitely tough to do Suprabhatam at 5. Okay, but in the hostel it is made. It's ensured that you get up at 5. That your TV viewing is restricted to only this much time. You go home in the vacation, you know, the parents say, oh, you know, this child has been deprived so much, so enjoy. Get up at 8 in the morning, see TV the whole day, and it's gone. If this happens during the summer vacations when it comes to the hostel, when it comes to day scholar, it's almost the other way. Because you see, so many times the teachers request the parents saying that this is what we are doing in the class, this is what we are doing here, but we need cooperation from you. That is what all the parent-teacher meetings are all about. So, the Ramayana, when we see, it also gives us subtly a very, very powerful reminder that as parents, we have a huge responsibility and it involves making sacrifices for the good of the child, just as Dasharatha did. You know, ready, though he had everything at his beck and call, though he could provide everything to Rama, Lakshmana, Bharata and Shatrughna, he didn't provide anything extra, and Rama, Lakshmana, Bharata and Shatrughna led as frugal a life as, say, the son of a potter, the son of anybody else in the ashram, and all were equal. And that is a very, very important thing for us to keep in mind.
In fact, this is a much larger discussion itself. You know, just a couple of weeks back, I read an article which was bemoaning the fate of the public education system in the country, and which is the major cause for, you know, the level of education itself to have come down. So they were saying just about maybe 30, 40 years ago in the 50s, 60s, maybe in the time when our parents were in school and our grandparents, it was almost ensured that the public schools would have the best teachers.
The government schools.
The government schools. You know, even when I was a kid, when I was talking to my grandfather, they would always have those teachers who were ideals. They would say that, you know, this teacher, I still remember, he used to teach us maths. He was an ideal teacher. You know, with the commercialization of education, you have these big players coming in. And then there is the need for attracting all these teachers into those schools. And you're not only attracting good teachers into those schools, but the schools which have different cultures. You know, today if I am earning, a man is earning 3 or 4 lakhs per month, he's definitely not going to put his son or daughter in a school which does not have air-conditioned rooms, which does not have those luxuries which kind of, distract you from the very purpose of education. But that was not the case in those days when, you know, the best school you could put your son or daughter in was a public school, was a government school, where you would have very simple but sincere teachers. You know, this commercialization of education is, I don't know how we could, you know, we are going to be able to set it right. One of the beautiful models which Swami has given us is the university itself, the schools and colleges which Swami has started. But, you know, how it's going to be taken up And it's very difficult looking at it.
That is why I say, you know, it's after all the drops of water that make the ocean. Yes, you know, it seems like a humongous task, because if we see in every way, the world seems to be messed around, not only in the education sector, if we see the financial sector, the economic sector, the value sector. I mean, anything you see everywhere, it looks messed up and you don't know where to begin. It's best to begin with one's own individual self, you know. Because, as you said, the way a person, just because he has the affluence and wealth, he wants the best for the child, he is wrongly thinking that his love for the child is expressed this way. For example, Dasharatha could have just told Vasishtha, you just leave all those guys, you come here, whatever you are going to get from all that, I will give you. You just come, be in the palace, stay in the palace for 15 years. He could have, you know, in quotes, homeschooled his 4 sons. But no, there is a reason why the children have to be sent. And they have to learn to fend for themselves and live for themselves, because it is like a, you know, in a hostel, for example, and you say it's a mini society there. And if you are able to cope with and adjust there, you know, in this mini society, if you fail to cope, what is the punishment or problem? That you get a reprimand from a teacher. That you get scolded and you get punished. Or you suffer a kind of stigma in your own room or among your classmates. But then we forget that it acts as a kind of a simulator for real life in the society. Because the same mistakes, you know, you go and steal some extra food, you get punished. You go and steal outside, you get jailed. So that's why the hostel acts as a beautiful simulator where you can learn. You learn. In the hostel you learn, yes, everything is not fair. Yes, sometimes some people seem to be getting away with what they do. And some people, though being good, they seem to be getting punished. But that's how the real world is outside, right? So it's a beautiful simulator where everybody is put on par and you learn. And then you are so much well prepared to come out into society and face the larger society, face the society at large outside. So, lot of lessons to learn from this Gurukula system of education that the four brothers underwent under Vasishtha. One more aspect that we are forgetting is the greatness of Vasishtha.
Right.
You know, Vasishtha, there is nothing that he lacked in life, because in the ultimate sense, he is a God-realized person. He has no need of anything. Just like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, I have no duties to perform in the world. And yet I do actions as if I am duty-bound. Same could be said about Vasishtha. What a glorious teacher. And imagine having realized, if we see the olden times, the Ramayana times, the times of Lord Krishna, the greatest people, the God-realized people, what did they choose? They chose the teaching profession. Because it is something that requires maximum effort, maximum kind of investment, because that is the future you are growing. The problem again we see nowadays is, nobody seems to invest. I'm putting the word invest in quotes, because invest doesn't mean money investment. The investment of values, the investment of the kind of people into education that we need, because apparently it doesn't seem to pay. When you invest in education, you see the result after 40 years.
Right.
When that person is now heading a company and he says, this is how it is, and people marvel and say, you are so ideal, you are so wonderful, you have put us on right track, how is it? And he says, my teachers taught me this in school. Vis-a-vis somewhere else you invest, you get immediate results. So, it requires a lot of foresight, a lot of deep thought to be able to invest in such a manner. And in those days, the greatest people, the most phenomenal, and by greatest I mean in terms of spiritual attainment, who have achieved everything and have no need from the world at all, even such people came and actively involved themselves in this system of education. That is another lesson that all of us should learn.
In fact, the beautiful thing is, you know, we often talk of bringing that ancient system into a modern context. That is what Swami has beautifully done. In fact, he's never spoken about it and said that this is what has been done. If you look at it, you know, we have spoken many times of the caste system which was there and how it got corrupted and it was rightfully had to go. But initially, you know, you had this Brahmins, which was supposed to be the highest caste.
Mm.
But the duty of any person in the society was to do dharma to a Brahmin, was to do charity to a Brahmin. You know, you are having the highest class. If it is really charity which is important, they should have told you do charity to the poor who is maybe the lowest caste.
Hmm.
But it is said that you have to do charity to a Brahmin. If you look at it, you know, a Brahmin works not for the remuneration he gets. A Brahmin is supposed to be one who is supposed to be sustained by the society, but he is supposed to do his work.
He is supposed to sustain the society.
Right. So he is supposed to do his prayer, meditation and all those things related to that, but he will be sustained by the society. So his work is not directly proportional to what he gets.
Hmm.
So to such a class of people, if you do charity, they will work more. But if you look at the lower class, they earn for the day. But if you go and give them money, they will say that, okay, if I can get so much money, then I can work this much less.
Hmm.
So it is said that your charity should propagate more work, should lead that person to be more active. That is why it is said that you have to give money to a Brahmin. Because the Brahmin, when he is well sustained, he'll work more.
Hmm.
And then if you look at it, what were the portfolios the Brahmins handled in those days, in the kingdoms like, you know, Vasishta?
One definitely is education.
One is education, the other is medicine. Because yes, the whole yes. Ayurveda was being handled by these Brahmin class. So what did Swami do? Swami said, I will give free education and medicine will be free.
Wow.
So the essence of that was brought in a modern context by Swami.
Hmm.
Because he's saying that education should not be commercialized, because when you sustain an education model, it should sustain the society. It should not be based on how much money you give, how much work you do.
And, you know, Prem, I'm just getting goosebumps here, you know, because that's exactly what has happened when I think of my own life. Whenever anything we speak, I think of it in terms of my life, because that is what I think I have complete mastery on.
Right.
On my own life and my experiences. When I think on one of the most motivating reasons why I wanted to stay back here is because I felt, oh my God, Swami has done so much for me. Let me do something. As you rightly said, the charity that Swami did for me, it is a really, in monetary terms, it's a big charity, Prem. It's worth about 8 to 9 lakhs, my education. Because I didn't pay a pie for my bachelor's, for my master's, for my MBA degree. I didn't pay a pie. And I know my sister did an MBA from a B graded university.
Okay.
Ours is A++. A B graded university. And her fees for 2 years was something, only fees, was something like nearly 3 lakhs.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that my whole education is worth about 8 to 9 lakhs. And it was given to me. It was just handed down to me on a platter. And when I asked, literally when all of us asked, what do you want? Now you have given us so much, what do you want? He says, no, just get a good name for yourself. Just get a good name for yourself, which will get a good name for the university, that's all. That is all is the payment that is asked for. You know, it charges you so much, it makes you get tears in your eyes thinking, oh my God, what a sacrifice, how much is being given, I must definitely do something. It inspires. It inspires you to work more, even at the cost of getting a lesser salary or no remuneration, because it's almost like, imagine if I had not done this, I would have had a 10 lakh rupee loan on my head. And you know, in some countries, for example, recently when I heard Professor G.V. Sir speak to educationists in New Delhi, mm-hmm. he was speaking about how in the United States of America, the moment a student passes out of university, he or she cannot think about a wedded life or a married life or anything like that till they turn 40 or 41, unless they have a huge, you know, parental okay. backing in terms of finances.
Mm.
Because
I mean, if they've undertaken an education
yes.
based on a loan.
Yes, because they would have taken the reason he says is because they have taken an education loan and it requires you to work for so many years to pay it back. And by that, because you do not want to get into a commitment and a relationship unless you are financially independent. And of course, that brings in the other evils of credit cards and such things, leaving that aside. So unless you're 40, 41, you don't think of marriage. And after you're 41, 42, even if you get a child, and hoping that your marriage doesn't break, if you're there, by the time you retire from work, your child is about 16 or 17 only. And now your child has to go to college. You are in no position to finance your child. The child has to take another loan. Now this loan becomes even bigger because you had got 20% from your father or mother and the rest was a loan. Now this is 100% loan. Which means this child, unless till it becomes 44 or 45 is not going to think of a child, which will put a greater burden on that person's child. You know,
and right.
It's a kind of building up pressure. It goes on and such a thing it is. And when I think of that, you know, I finish my education, I walk out midwife degree, I am literally a free man. I have no debts to repay, I am nothing. You know, just thinking of that from a pure, forget the spiritual aspect, forget the emotional support that Swami has given me. Surely from a materialistic point of view itself, as I walk out with my degree in hand, I have tears of gratitude because Prem, I am a free man. I am a free man and whatever I start earning from day one is mine. And that is when I suddenly realize, no, it's not mine. He has not given me a loan or anything, but even then he has given me so much. When somebody has given me so much, I should. And I feel that is what will happen if we are able to make education free. You know, because as you said, that is something that will inspire us to do more and give back more. Rather than the other things which will make you feel that this is free, so let me do less work anyway, it is coming. Beautiful, beautiful concept and beautiful lessons to learn.
Very true. No, there was this gig which caught on in McDonald's, I think, where you pay ahead. There was one man who bought his meal and paid for the meal for the person behind him. And, you know, the surprise is the person goes up to the counter and the lady in the counter says that your meal has already been paid for.
Wow.
So it started like a chain where each one pays for the person behind them. So each one was paying, but was paying for the person who's behind them, who's going to take the food after them. So it said that it became such a huge hit that it started in so many stores all across the world, where each one is not paying for themselves, but paying for the person who's going to come after them. In a sense, that is what Swami has started in such a huge level. You know, Swami has given for our education, and it is but spontaneous for us to think that, you know, I should be able to give for somebody else. It's precisely, one of my classmates once said that, you know, he had a problem where he couldn't manage the mess fees. For some reason, his father was in a bit of a problem in that particular semester. So one of the teachers who studied in Swami's college and who became a teacher and was staying in the hostel, very quietly called him aside and he said, I just saw your name on the list for people who have not yet paid the fees. So he said, will you permit me to pay your fees for this time? So this boy was...
Just to clarify for our listeners, this is the mess fees.
Right, mess fees, not the education fees. You know, that's a very, very meager amount given the, you know,
I think when I was in MSc, it was something like 7,000 rupees, which is about $120 per year for the food and electricity and water that I consume during the whole year.
Which is like very, very nominal honestly. So this teacher said that, you know, will you permit me to pay for you? And that's how he put it. But this boy was nevertheless embarrassed. He said, no, sir, I've already spoken to my father. He will send me the money. So this teacher said, see, you don't have to feel bad about it. Whatever I am today is because what Swami has given me. I cannot go and pay back Swami, but I can pay for somebody who needs. And that is what Swami expects. And in a real sense, this what happened in Starbucks or in McDonald's, the pay behind, has happened in such a huge level through Swami's education and medical mission. Because, you know, when we have done documentaries, how many people we've heard, they come in and they get free treatment in the hospital. And when they realize there is no way they can pay back, they say, okay, let me give up a bad habit. Let me come back and become a sevadal here. And that is a chain which Swami has started.
The chain of goodness.
Right.
Oh, Prem, once again we
then
move.
Where is Ramayana in all this?
There is Ramayana in all this, Prem. This is what is Rama Rajya, you know. This is what is the glorious ideal kingdom that anybody envisions that it would happen, where each one lives for the other and everyone lives for God. So we will go into the Ramakatha Rasavahini proper after this little break. Thank you, dear listeners. Hope you enjoy and don't mind these digressions. Let us confess that, frankly, these are not planned at all. It's just the inspiration that Swami is sitting in the heart and sending out, and it comes out with our words. We just hope that we have been hollow, empty flutes, and we don't pollute His inspiration with our own thoughts and ideas. This is just His inspiration. After the break, we will continue with Rama's story, and at the point when Dasharatha comes to take back the princes after their education is complete.
రఘురామ జయం రాఘవ రాముల ప్రేమమయం రామ జయం రఘురామ జయం రాఘవ రాముల ప్రేమమయం శాపతి రాఘవ మంత్రం రామ సీతాపతి రాఘవ మంత్రం ప్రేమని గుణగణ సేవ నిరంతరం రామ దయా పర పరమ పవిత్రం రఘుకుల దశరథ సుత పుత మిత్రం రఘుకుల దశరథ సుత పుత రామ జయం హరి రామ జయం రాఘవ జానమి ప్రేమమయం రామ జయం రఘురామ జయం రాఘవ ప్రేమమయం శ్రీరామ జయం రఘురామ జయం రాఘవ జానమి ప్రేమమయం రామ జయం రఘురామ జయం రాఘవ ప్రేమమయం రవికుల దశరథ సుతముత మిత్రం రవికుల దశరథ సుతముత రామ జయం రఘురామ జయం రాఘవ జానమి ప్రేమమయం రామ సీతాపతి రాఘవ మంత్రం రామ సీతాపతి రాఘవ రామసి గుణగణ సేవ నిరంతరం రామసి గుణగణ సేవ నిరంతరం దశరథ సుత ముత
Saram, dear listeners, welcome back. We were speaking about how Dasharatha arrives at the hermitage of Vasishta and he has come to inquire about the progress his children are making and whether the time is now right and right for him to take them back, has their education been complete. And as soon as he arrives, the four brothers, they rise up dutifully and they go and prostrate before Dasharatha. They touch his feet, they touch their father's feet in all respect. And then they stand in obedience when Vasishta invites Dasharatha to come and take a seat. They take a seat and Dasharatha starts asking Vasishta about how his children have performed and how they have done. You know, it's almost like a PTA, a parent-teacher's meet going on there. And one interesting thing that happens now is, as the discussion progresses, you know, Vasishta is just about to explode into praises about the four princes on how well they have done, how they have learnt everything and all that we spoke about, Rama knowing the Vedas and all the brothers excelling in every subject that they take. So just as Vasishta begins to speak about them, you know, Rama gets up, and following his lead, the other brothers also get up, and they bow to the preceptor and to their father and seek permission to leave the premises and go out. And, you know, this is such a beautiful, again, a small and subtle but a very profound message on how one should behave in the presence of elders. And when the elders are speaking about them, it is not nice to stand and hear, because, you know, it is natural that in case, you imagine if Vajita wants to complain something, it might be uncomfortable to do it in the presence, right? So, on their own they walk out, and Dasharatha and Vasishtha can't help but marvel at the wisdom that is embodied in that little frame of Rama. At this time, Rama is something like 10 or 11 year old, that's all. The brothers are all 10 to 9, 10, 11 year old children. And yet, they already have this decorum and decency built in. And both father and preceptor are very pleased with this behavior.
There's a beautiful thing in this, you know. Whether it was going and prostrating to Dasharatha, or, as you said, walking out of the room and the elders were discussing. The first move was always Rama's. You know, Rama goes and does it, and the others just follow it.
Mm.
And we talk of them as exemplary in their behavior. But in essence, the other brothers did not do anything which showed their behavior. They just followed what Rama did.
Correct.
You know, a beautiful message where what you have to do is follow that divinity within you.
Follow the master.
Follow the master, and, you know, whatever has to fall in place will fall in place. And whatever was the decision which was being made, or the discipline which was being displayed, was displayed by Rama. And just by following whatever he was doing, all the others were also getting that good name and that...
The exemplary status.
You know, the recognition from the master and...
Beautiful message. Just, even if you don't understand, just follow. Follow the master, follow God, and automatically your behavior becomes ideal. Your way of life becomes dharmic.
You know, talking about Rama just moving out when the conversation is happening. I remember sometime back in a write-up about personality development.
Mm-hmm.
I was saying one of the keys to a gentlemanly behavior, if you want to have a gentlemanly behavior, just control your curiosity. He said that desire to know what others are talking, he said that is the thing which will pull you down and make you look so gross in front of others. He said, so if you can control your curiosity, you will automatically become a gentleman.
If we actually look into our own lives, Prem, it is so ingrained, right? If we hear two people talking something,
right, you know that
we want to listen.
The desire to eavesdrop is so...
And especially
compelling.
If it's about you,
right?
There is no way you may go behind a wall, hide and then listen, because it is so strong that you want to know what is it that... We are so interested in knowing what the world thinks about us.
Right.
I think we should concentrate more on what we truly are. And that the Lord knows. So I think our focus should be on what the Lord thinks about us. Forget what the world is thinking, because that is bound to change. Good today, bad tomorrow. Bad today, good tomorrow. But what we are is what we should focus on. And that is what God thinks about us.
That is what Swami is portraying here. You know, in every little description of the behavior of these princes, that's what Swami is saying, that dignity with which they carried themselves. You know, that is so overflowing in all the description that Swami gives, the way they behaved in the ashram, the way they behaved in the presence of their father, in the presence of the master. And then Swami is breaking it down to what did they actually do. So if you really want to have a dignified being or demeanor about yourself, these are the things you have to do. Respect where it's required, and, you know, get yourself out of the picture where it's required, in the way you have to carry yourself every moment.
So Vasishtha then continues to tell Dasharatha, after praising all the pupils, he says, O king, I don't think there's anything left that I can teach them. They've learnt everything. It's time for them to now, you know, learn the other martial arts, archery, and other things.
For the prince.
Yes, the teenage years should be spent in that, because education-wise, I think it's complete. And they are ready, you can take them home. I'm very pleased, I have no complaints. I have only good words and wonderful words to offer about them, because that is how they have been for the last 5-6 years. And he heaps so much praises on them. Immediately Dasharatha sends word for Sumantra, who is there, and he tells them that, you know, go to the rush back to the palace, tell the queens that the children are coming home. So, you know, we were speaking about this concept of how the kings would sustain the Brahmins or the Gurus, how society would sustain them. He tells them to get things for Guru Dakshina.
right.
which the princes will offer to their guru. So you see, there's nothing like a compulsory fee. Whatever, seeing the children, you know, it's all result based. Seeing your children being so perfect, being so wonderful, the parents naturally feel so happy, and in their joy, they offer, you know, via their children to the guru as Guru Dakshina. And since it is in their joy that they offer, you know, there is nothing like a fixed amount. It's not as if you pay 150 gold coins per year, per student, per semester.
Per credit.
Per credit. Yeah. So the king offers more, and the poor pauper offers less. But it's all like a family. You know, when you're in a family, you'll have one son earning more, maybe one son earning less. But overall, for the family expenses, those who earn more, put in more. Those who earn less, put in less. But the family lives happily. I mean, I'm talking of the days of a joint family. I don't know if two brothers live together anymore. But when it is a joint family, that is what happened. That here was a live depiction, a perfect portrayal of the whole kingdom being one family where everyone puts in to their best ability for the welfare of others. And so Dasharatha sends word to Sumantra, and the queens along with the Guru Dakshina in the chariots, they rush towards the hermitage to receive their children.
Now, when you were talking about receiving so much from Swami and the desire to express our gratitude, you cannot give back anything. You know, it's a very interesting thing. Swami never expected gratitude from us.
Hmm.
Swami would, whenever anybody would say thank you, Swami would very jocularly say, not mention or do not mention or something like that, because he really meant it. Because he never wanted gratitude from us. But at the same time, Swami always spoke about gratitude also.
Mm.
Swami said, you don't have gratitude to God. You know, a person picks up a handkerchief and gives it to you, you say, thank you. God has given you so much, you don't have gratitude. In a essence, Swami is saying that God does not require your gratitude, but have gratitude, because gratitude is a good value to have.
It's a good thing for you.
Good thing for you. And that is what I think even these perfected masters like Vasishtha and all did. They did not need that Guru Dakshina which the disciples brought. But it is good for that disciple to want to give back something to the Guru who has given them so much.
Beautiful point. Beautiful point, Prem. And that is what exactly happened. The queens arrive and they have brought the Guru Dakshina. And the pupils, Rama and his three brothers, they offer the Guru Dakshina to Vasishtha. And they fall at the feet of the preceptor, take his blessings for the life ahead. And you know, the beautiful relationship that exists between the teacher and student. Swami says that the mother points out the father to the child, and the father points out to the guru to the child, which invariably, and the guru finally points out God to the child.
Right.
It invariably means that for every child, the most important people in the life are the mother, the father, the preceptor, and God. And it's almost as if Swami is saying, telling us, that if you give prime importance to these four, mother, father, preceptor, teacher, and God, your life is done. At least to these four, you have to pay your gratitude. So, when we look at the life of Rama, such was his behavior, such was his exemplary nature, that Vasishtha, when he embraced the four princes, he had tears in his eyes. He knew that he was going to miss them. Such had been the bond, like, you know, you cannot say that it is like between a father and the son, because it is like between a teacher and the disciple, the teacher and the pupil, because that's a unique relationship in itself. And today when we look at the alumni from the university, if you ask me, again I'm going back to my personal, when I think, definitely I think of about 2-3 teachers from school and from the institute who have had such a profound impact on my life, and I don't think throughout my life I'm ever going to forget them, because I shall always remember, and they'll always be my heroes, and I shall always wish that I can be like them. And that is a special relationship which I cannot compare with anything. I cannot say that they're like a father to me. No. They're like a brother to me. No. They're a teacher to me, and it's a unique relationship in itself. And that was a beautiful relationship that existed between the four brothers and Vasishtha also.
Very beautifully put, Arvind. And after this, they go, you know, it's very interesting in that sense, in the later years, in 2009 and later, we've seen Swami becoming emotional when his mother was mentioned, or when even somebody would speak about Swami's love. You could see Swami becoming emotional, and that would be something which was very difficult for us to accept, because this is the Swami who was so detached, who was so in the world, but definitely out of it. Swami was becoming so emotional. When you talk of Vasishtha, he's shedding tears when, you know, these four princes leaving his ashram and going away. That's what you think of. Because in the initial, we played a discourse where Swami says, Vasishtha was one who was always immersed in that self. But when he came to know that he could be near the descent, when God comes down, he wants to be near, he comes, and that is why he comes. A realized soul still giving into that emotion of separation, of missing, you know, Rama and the brothers. That's very interesting indeed.
Very interesting. In fact, Swami writes in the Ramkatha Rasavahini that once the princes leave, Vasishtha realizes that he has got so attached to the beautiful, bewitching, captivating form of the Lord. And we will be able to associate with it so much. Because when that form is no longer there, he is unable to bear the agony. And that is when, you know, the great Vasishtha himself has to go into meditation and contemplate on the reality of Rama. He realizes that Rama, Lakshmana, Bharata and Shatrughna are actually the embodiments of Dharma, Artha, Kama and Moksha, the four Purusharthas who have arrived to show the way to mankind. And it is only when he is able to contemplate on the reality of Rama that the sorrow in his heart quells, he feels at ease, he is back to his serene, peaceful, atmic joy self. And again, that is another message for all of us, because all of us feel the pangs of separation from that beautiful form of Swami. The only way to overcome that grief that we feel when we think we are missing the form, beautiful form of Swami, is to contemplate on the reality that Swami is, on Swami's reality. To contemplate on who Swami is, that is when we will find our sorrows receding and we being filled again with that atmic joy.
No, very true, because many times we say that, you know, Swami left. Swami has become the, you know, what do you say, Swami has become the ethereal one. Swami
form
has
to formless.
You know, become the formless one. The fact of Swami was always that. Swami never was for a moment not that, you know, beginningless, endless, absolute. It was just that we could see him only in that form. So in that sense, you know, Vasishtha missing Rama and all that, it's not because the divinity of Rama was diminished. It is just that for a moment he found that, you know, that boy who was in front of him, his student, was the boy who was giving him joy. So he had to remove himself from that idea and say that, no, I'm already in possession of that absolute.
It's almost like we going to a, you know, virtual reality. When you go into virtual reality, you know it is false. You know it's entirely false. Yet with the knowledge that it is false, we go there because we want to enjoy it, just have fun. And when we come out of it, yes, we miss it, but that is when we have to contemplate on, hey, that is virtual reality, that's not reality. And then we miss it no longer. But if we are not able to contemplate on its reality, that is when we become addicts. You know, and addiction is bad. That is what happens. So, in that sense, we have all got addicted to Swami's form. So, de-addiction will happen only when we are able to contemplate on His, which is nothing but our own reality. And that is another subtle yet profound message that comes from this episode. I am reminded of a brother's experience, you know. Because when we speak of our attachment to Swami, it happens so deeply that we do not realize later it becomes an impediment. We had in one satsang mentioned about how the beautiful form of, I mean, not the beautiful form for me personally, but for Ramakrishna, it was the beautiful form of Mother Kali. How that form itself became an impediment for him.
Right.
In overcoming and how he had to cut. So too, you know, to this brother, this incident is so profound and pregnant in its message. This brother had the chance of serving Swami at his residence, and it was sometime, I think, in 2002 or 2003, I think, because Swami had just had the fall and he was finding it a little difficult to walk without assistance. And the doctors were saying that he will recover soon, and they had done something. So one night, you know, this brother noticed that Swami was trying to call out to another brother who was also there in Swami's room. And he assumed that this was because Swami wanted assistance to go to the bathroom maybe. So it was the middle of the night, and since Swami is calling out the other brother's name, he did not deem it fit for him to get up and tell Swami, "I am ready." But Swami called out very softly once or twice. You know, later on we will understand that all this is part of the master plan. Swami was calling out so softly that the other brother, who was a little far away, apparently was not hearing it and he was still asleep. So this brother thought, "You know, let me get up. Let me go and wake him up. I will not look at Swami at all. I will just go wake him up and come back and lie down again, so that Swami need not, you know, call out 2-3 times to him. At the same time, it is not as if I am getting up and helping Swami when I am not being called." So he got up to go and wake up the other brother when Swami looked at him and said, "Hey, stop, don't wake him up." And Swami said, "You come here." His brother went to Swami and Swami said, "Sit down." So as is his practice, he sat at Swami's feet and he began to press. Swami said, "No, sit up here on my bed." He said, "No, Swami, I am fine over here." Swami said, "No, you sit up here." And he sat beside Swami on Swami's bed.
Okay.
And then Swami asked him, "Tell me, what will happen to you if I am gone?" This was like a bolt from the blue for him, because he never thought that what was the need for such a question. And he just, you know, in his mind he felt that Swami has just had his operation now, and you know, the physical pain might take you in quotes a kind of a low. You know, the physical pain can make you feel low a little bit. So he said, "Swami, the doctors are saying that within a few days Swami will start walking fast and even start running. So don't speak like this, Swami." Then Swami smiled and said, No, you just tell me answer what I'm asking. What will you do? What will happen to you if Swami is gone?" Then this brother realized that Swami was very sincere, very serious. He realized the gravity of the question and he said, "Swami, if you're gone, I won't be able to stay. I also will be gone, Swami." And then Swami smiled and said, I know, and I will prepare you before I go. So don't worry. Now go to bed." That's all was this interaction. And that is an entire subject later on, as to all that this brother underwent after that day. You know, it is very, very difficult, very terrible, and doesn't seem to make sense unless you know this episode. And for the whole world, it seemed such a terrible thing happening to this brother. But for this brother, he did not feel anything, because he knows. He knows, and somewhere in his heart, he knows that this is all the preparation that is happening for something. And recently when I happened to meet him, he said that, you know, Swami really prepared me. Because if 24th April had happened, really I would have dropped dead. I would have gone. And I am sure that Swami has some reason why he wants me alive. And it's with gratitude I can say that Swami has prepared me so that I can take this. And when I asked him, what is it that happened, he had actually been kept away from all this, you know, from Prashant Nilayam itself.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, all the while, whenever thoughts would come, I would keep remembering who is Swami. You know, I might have walked with him, talked with him, dined with him, touched his hand, pressed his feet, had jokes, cracked jokes, everything. But let me not forget who Swami is. And you know, when you hear to that experience, you realize how important it is to contemplate on Swami's reality, which is nothing but our own reality, because Swami says Prema Swarupalara, Divyatma Swarupalara. And that is the only way we will be able to overcome this pang of separation and this attachment that we have. I just thought that...
Very true. I think that's exactly what Vasishtha would have done at that moment. You know, when Rama and the brothers left, he goes back into meditation to realize that, you know, yes, I enjoyed their presence as little boys in my ashram, as my students, but their reality, because of which I have left, you know, my peaceful life in the forest and come and set up ashram here near a king, you know, kingdom, and serving as a teacher, is because of that reality what they were.
Hmm.
And remind yourself of that is what will let you realize that you can never be removed from that presence, or you can be away from that presence.
I really, you know, it's not as if I do it every time, but I have done it on quite some occasions, and I'm telling you, it is so powerful. You can use it like a talisman, a mantra, you know. Anytime anything happens to you where you feel that, oh God, something unfair is happening or something terrible is happening in my life, why is this happening? close your eyes and realize that you are in the bosom of Swami. Swami is, you are the dear child of Swami, and Swami is holding you close to the bosom, to His bosom. And then think of who Swami is. And once you start, you can never gauge or understand who He really is, but once you start picking at the little bits of His grandeur, you will then realize that will such a supreme loving Lord, will such a powerful Lord allow something like this to happen? You know, Swami who has said that anybody can criticize me, anybody can condemn me, you know, but if they touch a hair on my devotee's head, they will not be spared. You know, such a kind of protective Lord, such a kind of, if I can say, possessive Lord, such a kind of loving Lord, if He is allowing such a thing to happen to me, is it not that it is for my good? And even as we contemplate on that in this manner, our tensions and worries will start just fading away. Because you realize that it is just part of a master plan. And a master plan of a master who is the supreme atmic reality. I wish that I can incorporate this, what I am speaking. I hope that I will be the first listener and incorporate it more and more in life. Because that way you are able to remain stable and calm in spite of anything that is happening to you.
Right. So I think going forward in that story, what Vasishtha gave in his ashram was the knowledge of the scriptures. And that's what Swami says in Amgatha Raswaini. But now they had to go to that next level where they get equipped as Kshatriyas, as the rulers and the protectors of that country, of that land. And that is the next phase of their learning where Dashrata invites the best of archers and the best of people in the handling of arms and entrusts the prince in their care so that they learn these from them. And that's when the next phase of their education starts.
And as it happened in the case with Vasishtha, these people are surprised because Rama seems to be having great mastery over the bow and arrow, and he knows techniques, advanced techniques, which even the master archers are unaware of. It becomes more like a learning experience for the master archers from Rama rather than Rama learning from the master archers.
And I think after this, one particular thing which Swami mentions in this phase when they're going out to learn the art of archery, Swami says that one common thing in all those brothers is that they all refuse to take live targets. You know, that is one thing which we always read about the kings. One of their favorite pastimes is to go out hunting, to go out in search of game. But this is one thing which Rama refuses to do. He says that I will not shoot at an innocent bird or an animal. Though he well can. You know, it is not that he cannot shoot a moving object. He cannot shoot a live entity. But he's saying that why should we harm something which has not harmed us?
The beautiful thing in this is, you know, Rama is able to keep his focus on the purpose of archery. You know, he, not only Rama, the other brothers also tell their teachers that, you know, we are learning archery to protect and safeguard. This is something that is taught even in martial arts, you know, when you're learning, you're taught that this is for defense. It is not for offense. And the greatest masters say that it is most important to imbibe the principle before you actually learn the technique. Because it is the principle that makes you responsible enough to be able to wield that power and technique. And so, while there is a temptation, you know, to show off your archery, what greater joy, it may seem so, it may appear so, than to show off and shoot, say, probably the eye of a moving bird. Wow, what an archer. But no, the principle of archery is for protection. It's for protection of the subjects, protection of life. How can a vidya, how can an education, how can a skill, a knowledge that has been taught to you for the protection of life be used for taking of life? And it is so beautiful that Rama reminds the teachers themselves about the principle behind this education and this knowledge, and that is why he never shoots live targets and always chooses to use it only for the protection of the people.
And then an interesting thing happens at this particular point in the story where, you know, Dashrata says that yes, you gain the knowledge of the literature, of the scriptures, you gain the knowledge of all the scripture, of the, the defense, you know, the archery and all those things which a prince requires. This is only the worldly knowledge. He says the prince should also have the spiritual knowledge. And he says that can be obtained if they go on a pilgrimage. And so he calls the minister, the most loyal minister, Sumantra, and he says that I want to send my sons on a pilgrimage. You know, I find this very, very interesting. He says, Swami puts it in words saying that they've obtained knowledge, the paravidya, they have to obtain even aparavidya, that which is the absolute knowledge, the knowledge of the inner self. I find this very interesting because, you know, yesterday we celebrated Buddha Purnima. You look at it, what did the father of Buddha do and what is Dasharatha doing here? You know, Suddhodana, right?
Suddhodana.
He says that I have to protect my son from aparavidya. You know, that's what he does. He says that I should make sure that my son does not come in contact with that knowledge of the self.
With the reality in
the kingdom. You know, you should not go into anything transcendental. But here is Dasharatha saying that if they have to be good kings, if they have to be people who will govern well, they not only should have this knowledge, but they should also have the knowledge of the higher self.
Perfectly in line, in consonance with what Swami says about hands in society, head in the forest.
Right.
It's almost like if your hands in society have to be good, then your head has to be well entrenched in the forest. You know, another important thing that comes out from this is Dasharatha wants his children to have a look at the reality in the kingdom. Because, you know, all said and done, when you are in the hermitage with Vasishtha, it is a different world altogether. You are taught the scriptures, no doubt, but the way you are living there is like an entirely different world. When you are in the palace, it's an entirely different world. The reality is something else. So, if you have to sit in the palace and yet be sure that you are not cut off from the reality, you have to experience the reality. This is something that we see in the lives of many great people. For example, when Mahatma Gandhi returned to India after his education in South Africa, one of the first things he did before becoming part of the political struggle or before becoming a leader was to travel the length and breadth of the country. You know, how can you represent a country when you don't know what the country is about? It is during this travel that he actually gave up. He used to wear a coat and a nice dhoti. He gave it up and he used to keep his upper body bare because he saw that more than 50% of people in India do not have a proper cloth to cover their upper body. They just use one cloth as one. And he began to use the same kind of cloth because if he is a leader of these people, he has to be like the people. He has to be of the people and then only he can be for the people. That is what Swami Vivekananda did. And that is why at the end of it he told that do not teach spirituality to a hungry man. Who feed him first, because he realized that spirituality is not a problem in India. The problem is about bare necessities. They don't have food to eat. You give them food and then they will be receptive to spirituality. All this, you know, the wisdom that Mahatma Gandhiji gained, the wisdom that Swami Vivekananda gained, was all through personal experience by traveling through the length and the breadth of the country. And that is what Dasharatha wanted his own sons also to imbibe, and that is why he sent them on the pilgrimage. And as Swami writes, during the pilgrimage they came across the social economic conditions, everything that was going on there, and they started feeling the need, you know, here we need to build a school, here we need to build a medical facility, here we need to provide water. And that is when they began, though they were not kings, they already began to realize the responsibilities that they have to take up. What are all the needs of their people and how much work they have to serve the needs of the people. That is something beautiful that happened. And because of this act of Dasharatha, the princes benefited because they learned so much. And the people also benefited because their princes learned about them. I cannot help but think of the parallel of what happens during the Gram Seva. It's almost like this. You know, when the Gram Seva started, I used to think that this is for the benefit of the people.
Right.
It is only after going for the Gram Seva I realized how much I have learned about the need that exists in the country and about how people are able to live such contented lives with having almost nothing compared to what I'm having. It was a great lesson in contentment, in peace, a great lesson in sealing on desires, a great lesson in being happy. And towards the end of the Gram Seva, I felt that I have benefited more. It is the villagers who have served me. And ultimately the villagers have benefited, the students have benefited, and Swami is happy. So, I mean, just can't help but draw these parallels.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly what Swami did. You know, when you first come to Swami, you say, Swami says that you're going to get an MBA or an MTech. We are thinking of what we can achieve with that MBA or an MTech or an MSc. You know, how much I can soar in the corporate world. But Swami says, I will give you that degree, but go and see this. And Swami is giving us a sample of what 70 to 80% of this country is going through. And then Swami is saying, I give you this degree. Do what you would do. Sensitize the person who is receiving that benefit and saying that now you're given the benefit. Now what will you do with that benefit? And that is what, you know, Dashrata was doing. The best of education was given to them. The best of training in the arms were given to them. And then they say that you go and see the land. See what the people need. So you've been empowered with a certain knowledge. And now you are being given a sample of what people go through. And now you are in a better position to know what to do with what you've been given.
Exactly. And as we already discussed, your education has been in such a manner that you have got used to living in the most...
Protected of environments.
Yeah, protected of environments. Not only that, like the way they lived in the ashram, you're able to live in the most meager of environments, because you are able to then... Having gone through that, you realize what it is. You know, many times you may look at a poor person and you may offer him sympathy. But if you have gone through such a situation in your life, you are able to empathize with him. And then compassion flows. You know, during the G.V. sir's talk in Delhi, it was so beautiful. He brought out the difference between sympathy, empathy and compassion. You know, okay. He said, what is the difference between sympathy, empathy and compassion? And I thought they are more or less synonymous. And then he says that, you know, sympathy is when you look at somebody and when you feel you are at a higher position, they are at a lower position, and you feel sorry for them. That's it. Empathy is when you have experienced what they have experienced, and therefore, when you look at them, the feelings towards them come. Because you know what it means to be that. In sympathy, you don't know what it means. It's like, I go to a mother who has lost her child and I say, you know, I know it's very tough. I have no idea what it means to lose a child. That is sympathy. Empathy is when one mother who has lost it speaks like that to the other mother. When we go to compassion, compassion is something that is action. When empathy leads to action, it becomes compassion. And that is why we say Bhagwan is so compassionate. Because he not only feels what we are feeling, he not only understands what we are feeling, he also acts in order to alleviate that suffering, in order to alleviate that pain. And that is what happened in the case of the brothers also. They became compassionate because of all this. I mean, in the sense, I'm speaking of this in the worldly sense. Rama being Rama, I'm sure with birth itself he was a compassionate one. But they became compassionate because of this, and when their entire tour concluded, one could be sure that when they become the rulers, the kingdom is going to be prosperous, fantastic, beautiful and lovely, because you don't have a sympathetic king, you don't have an empathetic king, but you have a compassionate king.
And before we spoke about this pilgrimage, we spoke about the difference between the father of Buddha and Dashrata. But there was a similarity between what happened to Buddha and what happened to Rama after this pilgrimage. But I think we'll go into that next week. We are almost near our ending time.
Yes.
So thank you, dear listeners, for being with us. And it is always so wonderful, you know, when we just listen to a Ramayana. It is just that maybe you could tell the whole Ramayana in 10 sentences. You know, there are verses like that. But if you look at it, there is so much deep meaning in every, you know, turn of events in the whole story. That's the beauty of Ramkatha Raswayani, because Swami highlights some of those little things which we might miss otherwise.
And that's what makes it from Ramkatha Vahini to Ramkatha Rasavahini, where we are able to juice out each incident and enjoy that nectar that is present in it. And it is with gratitude we are very grateful to Swami for having presented us that juice from his autobiographical account. We offer our salutations at his lotus feet. And of course, how can we forget our dear Hanuman, who is always present wherever the Ramakatha is being sung, is being narrated, is being discussed. So we offer our salutations to him and seek inspiration to become like him, where we live for God, we love God, and our entire life is God and God alone. With that, dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this segment of Ramakatha Rasavahini. You can write to us about your thoughts, your feelings, your feedback at listener@radiosai.org, listener@radiosai.org. And as Prem said, next week we shall go into a very less known phase that Rama went into, which Swami has described with all the authenticity of the avatar. That is definitely going to be a very interesting and wonderful topic for discussion. So do tune in next week too for the afternoon satsang, where we shall continue with the Ramakatha Rasavahini. As of now, we leave you with this song and our gratitude at the Lotus Feet. Thank you. Jai Sainam.
Come on.